dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. For more than 50 years, Israelis and Palestinians have been at war for control over the land each calls home. Religion, geopolitics, and history feed into a conflict that grows more desperate and lethal as the years pass. Within each society, a small but growing number of people are becoming convinced that they must take a stand to de-escalate the violence in order to make peaceful coexistence between their peoples possible. To do so, they have had to oppose both their governments and the general sentiment in their societies. Especially in the case of our first and featured speaker, Danny Voss, an Israeli soldier who is one of the founders of what has been called the Refusnik movement. Voss is among a group of about 500 Israeli soldiers who have refused to participate in maintaining the increasingly bloody Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories that has been in effect since the end of the 1967 war. Voss spoke in Ithaca last week.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. Like, it's a huge crowd. It's great to see so many people that are concerned for Israel. Whether you agree with me or not, it's a hard question, but Israel is in a time of great crisis and needs support. But I think that the question of what kind of support is an open question that I want to raise in this audience. I will try to explain my decision. Actually, it's not a decision that I took privately. It's a decision that me and other 480 officers and soldiers took, a decision which is quite extreme, to refuse to go and serve in the occupied territories. And I want to pose this question in how hard it is and how difficult it is by saying that first it's an act that we took now. We didn't take it 3 years ago when it looked as if peace is about to come. And we took it in the middle of terrible terror attack against Israel, a terror attack that we haven't seen such a terrible attack in the past. I hope it will end soon. But as for now, the end is not clear. And the second thing that makes this question so hard, this decision and question, why did we do it so hard, is that we're not a group of pacifists. It's not like, that's not the case. We're not pacifists. All of us, all the 481 people who took these decisions are people that served in the occupied territories in the past, served for many years in the army, and are extremely committed to Israel and to Zionism. And if we served so long in the army, I think it stands for itself. We are committed for Israel, and yet we took this decision in such a hard time. So I'll try to answer this question by answering smaller question. One is how it all began, who we are, and how this movement, Courage to Refuse, came to life. The second is what we want to achieve in our struggle. And I Again, I have to say, I'm talking as a private person, 480 people. Probably some people have slightly different views from mine, but we're united with this signature that we put on the combatant letter that you're all welcome to read. So what do we want to achieve? And lastly, why am I speaking here in front of an American audience, I think mainly Jewish, but not only? Why am I, some people see it as taking and washing the dirty laundry outside. Why am I still doing it even when it's perceived as such? And I hope it's not. So I'll start by how it all began. It began with David Zonshin and Yaniv Itzkovich, two paratrooper officers that served their reserve duty in Gaza Strip last December, like they did many times before. But it was the first time that they did reserve duty during this intifada. And what they saw was extremely troubling for them. They saw several processes as they happened when they were there in Gaza Strip. And they saw this increase of violence from both sides. What they describe is a kind of something that led them to understand that it goes toward a disaster, is that in the first week of the reserve, they were in some ambush that Palestinians set. And it was okay, they dealt with it fine and there were no casualties. Everything was fine. Toward the last week of the reserve, they had another ambush. And what David told me is what they saw is a very, very fast learning curve that the Palestinians shows. They were very determined and they learned. The second ambush was way more professional and looked very much like what they used to see in earlier years in Lebanon, where they fought the Hezbollah prior. So it was clear that the amount of violence and aggression showed by the Palestinian side is growing fast, and also the Israeli army had to adjust itself, and their main duty was to protect their soldiers, which means that not out of cruelty or bad intentions, they had to enforce more and more stringent measures against the Palestinian population as a whole in order to protect their soldiers from the attacks of the Palestinians. They had to do it to all the Palestinian population because there is no other way to do it. You don't know who will attack you in a certain moment. And if you want to read, there is a pretty detailed account of the duty that they had to do there in Gaza in our website. So, and you're welcome to see it there. So one thing that they saw is this increase of violence from both sides that leads to no clear end. And the other thing that they also realized is that this increase in violence that the army shows is basically meant not to the protection of Israel, but to the enhancement and to strengthening the settlements in Gaza Strip. And I don't know if all of you know what does it mean. Gaza Strip is the most heavily populated area in the world. It has in a very narrow piece of land, a small piece of land, there are more than a million Palestinians and something like 12,000 Israeli settlers among them. And the hardship that both sides suffer because of living on this dense area together was incredible. And it was a situation that they felt that they're doing very, very, very unjust things, and they didn't see any bad intention in any side. It was simply the situation that basically enforced this brutality to happen. You as an officer must protect your soldiers. That's the main duty that you have, to bring all your soldiers to the end of this 3 or 4 weeks reserve duty safely back home. And when you have this main goal in mind, it means that you'll do everything to ensure it, and that the life of the Palestinians around you will be very, very hard. So they decided that basically the politicians or the high generals in the army send them to some mission that they can't do efficiently. On the one hand, they tell them the IDF must remain humane and must be strict about this moral code. That is something that the IDF has. And on the other hand, they must protect their soldiers. And that's the absolute measure of how you judge if an officer does his duty or not. And in this particular reality, they felt that they are doing basically things that should not be done against the Palestinian population. So they took a private decision. At the end of the reserve, they took a private decision that they will not do it any longer. They will not enact the occupation, they will not prevent people from moving, they will not prevent people from going to work, they will not enforce curfew and check things. Basically, they decided that they will not serve in the occupied territories again. They will not fight for the settlements there. And it began as a private decision that they took. Later on, they came back. They are both students in Tel Aviv University, so they put up papers in the university just trying to sense if they are alone in this feeling that what's happening is impossible or not. And they were surprised and basically, I think, happy to see that within less than a week, they 18 people called them and told them, well, we've been there, we've been in the occupied territories. So far, we obeyed commands and we did everything told to do, but we also feel that it shouldn't be done, that we done enacted commands that shouldn't have been issued at the first place. We shouldn't be there. And this feeling that basically what the army does is not producing security, but enhancing this settlement project. Having this pretty wide response that surprised them, they realized that they have maybe a bigger responsibility than taking this private act. It's two kinds of responsibilities. First, they understood that they are in a unique position, in a very, very powerful position, since people believe them. Like, it's not that they are Bezalem, that half of the people don't in Israel. Bezalem is a information centers for violation of human rights in the occupied territories. So it's not that they come from Bezalem and it's completely clear that it's biased, at least to a lot of the public opinion in Israel, it is clear. And it's not that they are from the Palestinian side that tells what is the reality that goes on in the occupied territories, that is also there. Like, it's not clear when they tell truth and when they exaggerate what's happening. And they are neither the IDF spokesperson, that is also, its credibility has been criticized in the last year or 2 years. So they realize that they're in a position that is unique by the sheer fact that people believe them. Actually, later it was also, when I joined, I also understood it for me, that we have this very powerful position. The other responsibility that they understood is that they were the people who prevented a person from moving, and they were the people who shot at someone who didn't really threaten their life in a very immediate sense. And what we always used to tell ourselves, we're in a democracy, we have orders, we obey commands, and the responsibility for an order, even when you don't disagree with it, the responsibility lies up there. They also realize that it is true, but it's only partly true. Part of the responsibility lies on the people who do the occupation with their own hands, the people who are really there. Truly, they are only a small part in this huge machine, and they can't stop the occupation with their both hands, but they are significant parts, because the machine is built out of these many, many small parts who eventually do this. So they realize that they have responsibility not to do things that they see as illegal. They must not do it. At this point, they decided to take their step one step further. They decided that they will not do what many other reservists do that oppose the occupation and don't want to serve in the occupied territories. Many people simply avoid serving in the occupied territories by telling their commanders all kinds of excuses, pretending to be physically disabled, pretending to go abroad. If you go abroad when you're called to do reserve, so the reserve duty is cancelled. So you can simply show your commander a flight ticket and the duty is cancelled for this year. They realize that they're not willing to take this easy way out, but they are going to struggle and to let people know about what they saw in the occupied territories from their first hand. So they started writing this letter, later to be known as the combatant letter, that declares that we are soldiers of the IDF, and proudly so. We are willing to protect our country everywhere and in any mission that we will be sent to, but we demand to do exactly this, protect our country and not do anything else. Not to go to do reserve in order to perpetuate the control over the Palestinian people, some territorial aspirations that is very controversial within Israel. Basically, we see it as illegitimate. At this point, they started gathering people that will be willing to sign such letter and to pay the price that might be part of it, meaning serve some 30 days in jail once you're called to do reserve in the occupied territories. And each of us, I received a phone call, and it wasn't an easy decision. A friend of mine knew that I might be willing to sign this letter, and it wasn't easy. At first, they sent me the letter on email, and I returned it back. I replied with a bunch of curses, saying that I'm not willing to sign a letter like this ever. But later on, I thought, I had these thoughts in the past that it's unjust to go to the occupied territories, that it doesn't serve Israel's security, and that we must find a way to take Israel back to it and to make clear borders to the state. Eventually, after talking with Noam, the guy who sent me originally the letter, I decided, actually, the truth is that I tried to do some changes in the letter, and I said, well, I'll say that I signed the letter and then proposed my changes, hoping that people will take it, but you can't just sit at the side and say, you should change this and this, and then I'll think, maybe I'll sign, maybe I won't. So I decided that I'll sign the letter, and I paid some money that we were gathering money in order to have an ad in the newspaper with our names. So I paid the money and I signed the letter, and they came with my proposition. Minor changes in the way the letter was written. Nobody really took care of it, but I was in there. And it was in January, and the letter came out with, I think, tremendous, it hit the country with tremendous wave of attention, of support, but mainly very heavy criticism to how can you do that in such a terrible time. And it's like a lot of criticism that I'll probably have to face soon when we move to question and answers. But since there, my confidence grew, and I realized that I shouldn't go to the occupied territories. I shouldn't serve in all those posts that makes the occupation possible. And that the situation is extreme enough to justify it. And again, I have to say, it's not an easy decision. I don't think that disobeying rules is something that one can do whenever he feels like, or something that I wish to see every day. It's very, very extreme, and I think it should be kept like this, to a very, very extreme situation, which we are in right now. So we published the letter, and it made this huge, attract huge attention of criticism and support. When we published the letters, we were 51. A week later, we were 100. 2 weeks later, we were 200 people who signed and paid the letter. Nobody is like, it's not an open letter that anyone can add his signatories. We interview people, we make sure that they are serious, that they will be willing to spend time in jail if needed. And everybody pays to be signed on this letter. There are exceptions, people that can't pay, don't pay. But now I'll try to say, what do we want to achieve? So in one hand, it's very clear what we want to achieve. We want Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. We want to put end to the occupation. We're not a group of politicians. So if you'll ask me a question such as where exactly the line should be drawn, how it should be done, in what steps, or who should we sign with, I don't have any clear answer for this. I think it's very important and hard question, but I don't have a clear answer for this. We leave it for the politicians. What we try to say in this letter is that we are not willing to do it again, and that the occupation, continuance of the occupation, is not an option. We'll not let it continue on and on and on. We'll do anything possible within the lines of our struggle, of course, non-violent struggle, to put end to the occupation. So we want to end the occupation. We want to strengthen Israel's security. That's another very important point. I think that I was aware of the high moral price that Israel pays for the occupation long ago. But sometimes I thought, well, it's necessary. Countries do wrong in their struggle to have security for their citizens. And I'm not a kind of naive pacifist who say, well, they shouldn't do that. I think that that's the way states work. That's the way this kind of apparatus protects its citizens. Sometimes they do wrong. And this small wrong is justified if it enhances the security of the citizens. I took this decision to sign this letter once I realized that this wrong, this huge wrong that is called the occupation, doesn't serve Israel's security. Otherwise, I would continue enacting the occupation with my both hands. That's very important. And we also want to strengthen Israel's democracy. This, it will probably be raised later in the question and answers part. But for us, what we see is not a kind of occupation that we are struggling for the Palestinians. We see how the Palestinians suffer, and therefore we struggle for them. I think that both sides of this conflicts suffer tremendously, not in the same way. We in Israel, in Tel Aviv, we don't suffer curfew. Well, like we never did, and I hope we'll never have to. But we still suffer. We pay a terrible price in the terror, in the continuance of the terror. But the price of occupation that Israelis pay is way higher than this. Sometimes it's not clear, it's not always even clear to members of Courage to Refuse, how come Israelis pay such a terrible price for occupation? And I think, well, they pay it all over in every aspect of life that we live. First, there is the fear. Even if we're not dying in a terrorist attack, we have this continuous fear that it's a great fear. It's not only a fear of some attack here or some attack there, but it's also a fear that every Israeli lives with of being in a country that everybody around us don't want us there. And I think the occupation is not alone in this reality, but it's certainly one of the major parts that make this fear really alive and real. This is one thing, but in addition to that, I think there is a wide variety of daily life issues that are not being addressed because everything in Israel is directed toward the managing of the occupation and the managing of the conflict in a way that people can live with. And just to give a few examples, environmental issues. Nobody knows in Israel about environmental issues. Israel is in a terrible environmental situation. It's heavily populated, it's industrialized, and there is no serious movement, green movement, environmental movement. There is a reason for that. I see the reason for that partly, not alone, but the occupation, that all the public attention, there is no mass movement that demands better environmental condition, better health, better education, better social security system, simply because all the efforts and the ballots, every once in 4 years, people put their decision in the ballot according to what should be done with the Arabs, what is the next step, how do you deal with them. And it simply undermines any other social struggle that can be fought, very important struggles. So the price that we Israelis pay, and I think that most of the Israelis don't realize it, is tremendous. And of course, there is this the price of the human rights violation that Israel does in the occupied territories that is very, very alarming. So we want to strengthen the democracy in order to enable all these issues to be raised. And we think that the first step in doing that is ending the occupation. But we also, it's still very vague saying we want to end the occupation is nice. I think another understanding that we gradually reached is that we want to do it by fostering a kind of debate about the occupied territories that is very different from what we usually hear and think. Usually a debate about what will be in the occupied territories is being organized either pragmatically in kind of strategic thinking that asks whether we can hold these territories and in what price. Do we have enough soldiers to do it? What is the price of it? But it's kind of strategic thinking that don't see the actual people that are involved, that pay the price. And it's a thinking that has its right, has a place to be thought, but it shouldn't take the other aspect. Another way that people usually talk about the occupation is with a more very moral and abstract debate. It's whether Israel has the right to control the occupied territories, and some people will say we have the right because they started. Some people will say we don't have the right, we started. And sometimes the justification are more religious in their kind. It's our promised land, we have the right to control it. We want to abandon these two kinds of ways to think and talk about the occupation in order to allow a different kind of talk about the occupation, some kind of talking about the occupation that comes from the level of the people who live there, both Israelis and Palestinians. I think it's important also to emphasize that the settlers in the occupied territories pay tremendous price for the occupation. They believe that it's necessary. I disagree with them in many aspects, but they pay terrible, terrible price for this. And their quality of life is not something that I want to experience. There are the Palestinians, and the life of the occupation that they encounter are very, very hard. Very great difficulty to move from a place to place, being under curfew for weeks and sometimes months, and not being able to work. And the figures and the facts about what this population faces are horrific. And not long ago there was a research that identified that something like 22% of the Palestinian children suffer malnutrition. Some of them suffer more severe malnutrition and some less severe. It's not a research done by Palestinians, it's American research. It's a terrible, terrible price for the enhancing of some enhancement of some territorial project. And we are confident that Zionism is more than a territorial project. Zionism is a great and noble idea, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to control all of this land. We can share it. So what we want to foster is a kind of talk of the occupation that comes from this daily reality of soldiers who have to obey commands that they feel very strongly that are wrong and that they are doing terrible things, that have to act brutal, not because they are brutal in their soul and inner being, but because they have to act like this in a certain situation. And sometimes the brutality pops out and it's not even within their control. There is a story, it's not something that happened to me, but I think it exemplifies so terribly how bad the occupation is, that, and how, and it also say how it's not in our hands any longer. It was told to me by Chen Alon. He's one of the leaders of Courage to Refuse. And he told me he was in Khan Yunis, in Gaza Strip, and they were enforcing curfew, which is pretty routine thing to do. A small group of four or five soldiers patrolling the alleys, making sure that nobody leaves the house, and somebody threw a stone at them. And they chased him, because that's what you do when something like this happens. And it was a 4-year-old child, and they ran, and almost caught him as he was banging the door of his house. And the father opens the door and see the soldiers and see the small kid and quickly understand what's happening. And he starts beating the child, brutally beating the child and begging the soldiers, please don't take him, I'm punishing him, and showing how hard he punishes the child. And it's a kind of situation like that is so terrible. You see, it wasn't in the hands of the soldiers. They weren't, Chen alone was there. They weren't intending to beat this child. It was the last thought that they have in mind. And the father, I don't know him, but I can also say maybe he wasn't a child abuser. But he was at this moment, and he acted that way because of the occupation, because of the mere presence of soldiers there. The soldiers didn't do nothing. They were simply walking in the alley. So we are determined not to let it, not to be the soldiers that stand in this situation again. We think we have the right. We think that the occupation is illegal. Every act of the occupation is illegal, and therefore we have the right not to serve there and to demand our country to solve this situation by withdrawing from the occupied territories. That's our agenda. I'll try to clarify a few more points, and then I'll be glad to, maybe we'll take some short break and continue with the Q&A. Few things that I think I said it before, but it's important to emphasize again. We're not revolutionaries. It's not a group of people. If I can think about like what is the profile of the members of Courage to Refuse, most of them are around my age. I think it's pretty homogeneous group, around 30 years old. It varies, but it's young people. Most of us professionals, people that work in high tech and other occupation, and pretty big presence to students and academics. And we're not revolutionaries. We don't want to change the state of Israel altogether, and we don't want to make any radical change in its character. We serve this country, we want to continue serving this country, and we love it the way we grew up in it. Meaning as a secure and democratic state, and what we want to, the message is that the occupation is not an option. For Israel, not for the Palestinians. It's obvious the Palestinian will gain independence if what we envision will come true. But this is not who we struggle for. We struggle for ourselves. We don't do any struggle for somebody else. And another thing that it's important for me to say is that we don't think, like, we don't come and claim that the IDF is brutal, that the IDF is a evil organization. We grew up in this place, in the IDF. Each of us spent a lot of his years there and gave a lot of efforts, and basically any one of you who knows Israelis know that a lot of our identity is built around what we did in the army and how we grew up in the army and the experience of being in the army. So we don't want to go and say that this organization we have nothing to do with. We feel that we're part of it, and we know, because we've been there, that the IDF has a very high moral ethics and has this notion of not humiliating, not abusing people when it's not necessary, and trying to avoid it as much as possible, of trying to be humane toward even your enemies and your worst enemies. And actually this is what we struggle for. We struggle to keep the IDF as it should be, as a moral organization that works along very strict moral codes. And we think that the occupation can't allow the IDF work in that way. And we struggle. Basically, our struggle is for us not to do illegal acts, And also for our friends and fellows in the platoon who decide to do go to the occupied territories and to do enact the occupation, to take them away from this situation, from this impossible situation that turns them and us as a society increasingly brutal. Now, I know that it's that a decision not to go to the occupied territories in any price, like the one I took, is extreme. It's not a decision that I would take for a minor thing. But I think that in the situation that we are in at now, after 35 years of occupation, it is necessary, even though I know you can ask many hard questions, I'll try to answer them to the best way I understand. There are some Israeli citizens here, but mainly not Israeli citizens. We had a lot of hesitation before we were even willing to give an interview to foreign media. When we went out, there was a huge wave of interest, and many foreign media people tried to interview us. We had great difficulty with us. We also thought that, well, this is an Israeli struggle that should be fought within Israel. But as our struggle continued, and we agreed to give interviews to foreign media only 2 months, or maybe 3 months, I don't remember completely, but long time after we came out, then we took this decision that we will give interviews to foreign media, and we will try to influence public opinion abroad, because we also realized that the occupation cannot continue without the active and very powerful support of the US at one hand, but even more importantly, the American Jewry, that is concerned for a good reason for Israel, and Israel is indeed under terrible attack, but as a whole, if I can do some kind of wide generalization, this immediate knee-jerk reaction of American Jewry to support the Israeli government with whatever it does, we think that it became very dangerous to Israel, to Israel's existence. I don't think that it's a struggle for the moral character of Israel. It's way more than that. It's a struggle for Israel's security, for Israel's existence. It's not about moral. It's way more important than that. Basically, what I'm asking, what I'm calling for you, I'm calling for you to refuse. Not in the same sense that we're refusing, and I'm not even saying that everybody should support Courage to Refuse as a refusal movement in this very controversial act, but to refuse this dictation that American Jewry in general were very responsive to, of supporting Israel no matter what, supporting the government, supporting Sharon no matter what. I'm asking you to refuse to obey this dictation, and to think carefully. If you really support Israel, if you really are concerned with the fate of Israel as a state for the citizens and for both the Palestinians and the Israelis, to think carefully what is good for Israel, whether the continuance of the occupation is something that should be struggled for or struggled against. I realize most of the political movements of Israel are heavily sponsored by American Jews, which gives American Jewry tremendous power. And it's a power that is even more than, it's not only financial power. I think also in Israel there is a certain feeling that not everybody all the time, even in times of huge support to Sharon, not everybody all the time are sure that what he's doing is accurate. And people look aside to see if everybody nods with their head and agree. And the agreement of the American Jewry is very important part in this. Basically, Israeli newspapers continually have reports about American Jews that come and meet Sharon and tell him, go forth and be strong. And this kind of, it's news that exists, not because it's so important or interesting that someone came to Israel and say, Sharon, kol hakavod, or you're doing right. It's important because it's someone who stands aside, who's able to have a slightly different perspective, and he's reinforcing that. As people who are both insiders and outsiders, and that's what American Jews are for the state of Israel, very concerned for Israel but basically don't live there, you have a very powerful viewpoint, and people in Israel realize it. And when American Jews say that they are concerned and they think that something wrong is happening in Israel, it has tremendous influence beyond what I said earlier about financing the settlements. So I think it's important, if you have doubts, if you have questions, if you think that maybe the occupation is not the best thing for Israel, shout it out. It's not a time to hesitate, and it's not a time to stand all united behind some train that moves to no end. That's all. Thank you.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
What I've tried to do is sort out similar types of questions so we can get as many answered as possible. So I will occasionally read several questions together that are very similar, just to give the feel. But the first one is, you said that the occupation is illegal. What do you mean?
I'm not a legal advisor. I don't have any legal background. So what I'm saying, take it with not as an advice from a professional, but I know that occupation in itself is legal according to the international law. Maybe it's not moral, maybe it's not just, but it's legal. But the way the occupation in the occupied territories, in this specific reality that we live now, is enacted, is largely illegal. And I can count the things: settlement, settling people from the conquering country in the occupied areas is illegal by conventions that Israel is signed on. So the settlements, the whole settlement project, over 400,000 people settled in the occupied territories in the last 35 years, it is an illegal project. Curfew, preventing people from movement, preventing people from getting their medical aid when they need it. All of it is illegal and doesn't go according to any standard of the international or the Israeli law. Taking people with no trial, imprisoning people with no trial is illegal. You name it. Like specifying roads that are for the movement of Jews only is illegal. Having two completely separate legal system for Palestinians and Jews that are not being brought into the same judge, that are not don't receive the same treatment at any point, is illegal. So under what we see, the occupation as a whole rests on all these hundreds and thousands of daily routine that all of them are basically illegal.
There are a series of questions about security, whether the claim that Israel's border will not be defensible if Israel withdraws, or whether the concern, how does courage to refuse address the concern of Israel being maneuvered to a defenseless position similar to Czechoslovakia in 1939 if they withdraw? And would withdrawal from the occupied territories not pose a significant security risk?
I think it is. I think withdrawing from the occupied territories is a significant risk. I think the state that we are, like, where we are now, is also very, very volatile and dangerous and explosive situation. I'm not a military expert that can give a confident and definite answer, but I believe that believe that Israel is defensible within the green line or without the occupied territories, and we believe that, but at large, enhancing the control of the on the occupied territories and the Palestinians that live there create insecurity. The situation of Israel with no clear borders, with no fence to prevent suicide bomber from going to Tel Aviv and Netanya and explode himself, is a very dangerous situation. We face it like almost daily. Israel suffered more than 600 casualties in the last 2 years. What we believe largely as a result of borderless state. It's very easy for Palestinians who want to suicide, not for the civilians who want to move from village to village and who wants to work. For them it's very hard. They need a car and they need to move from village to village and they simply can't do it. But for the determined young suicide bomber who wants to sneak into Israel, it's proved to be very easy and terribly easy. So, at the whole, we believe that withdrawing and marking clear lines will make Israel more defensible, not less.
Okay. There are a couple of questions about the response of Israelis to members of Courage to Refuse and their family, whether there's anger, isolation, whether there's support for the movement in Israel among the universities?
I think the answer is always, it varies. Like, some members of our group face sometimes pretty harsh reactions from their families, from their peers. I have a friend that when he was in jail, his family refused to meet him, to come and visit him, which is pretty painful. Others receive support. When we just came out and there was this huge public interest in us, so I think it was Yediot Ahronot, the largest newspaper, also did a poll to try to assess what people think about it, and find out that 22% of the Jewish population support the act of refusal or understand. I don't remember how it was termed. Now, it's clear that the support is much smaller than this. In more than 6 months of pretty hard work, we didn't reach even 1% of the people. We have 481 people who signed the petition. So it's clear that it varies, but it is a debatable issue, and the amount of people who are really willing to take the risk of sitting in jail is pretty small. The support is wider, especially in the like in universities. It's not unified, but considerable support. Other places, there are also calls to take our citizenship away and to deport us and to jail us for 10 years and 20 years, and worse than that. So, all kinds of.
Some questions about that you talked about in general terms being called upon as a soldier to do things that felt wrong or immoral or illegal. Can you talk a little more specifically about what you saw or what your friends have seen?
My position is a bit uncomfortable to answer this kind of question since I came from the Navy. I've been in the occupied territories, I served there, but I didn't spend, like, there are people, actually, even people here who spent most of their duty in the occupied territories. That's not the case for me. I was in a submarine and did only a few weeks in the occupied territories. So I can say something from my own experience and something from people that told me about their experiences. And again, you should visit our website and read more. But something that was shocking for me when I was in the occupied territories, it wasn't the last time, but one of the times, I was guarding in some camp just above Ramallah, where the Palestinian Authority is now. It was 94, or maybe the end of 94, which basically means a time that everybody, including me, believed that peace is coming, the occupation is something that belongs to the history, and there's no more occupation. And I remember being very surprised. I spent there a few weeks simply in a very boring routine of simply going to a kind of tower and inspecting, seeing that nobody comes to the base. And I didn't do anything. I didn't see anyone beating or acting brutally toward anyone, but it was above Ramallah, and it was a time of peace. And I remember that I was really surprised to see there was a jeep patrol every night, not from my unit, but from another unit, that did this routine of inspecting that nobody is doing something that the army don't want it to do. Now, I didn't see them doing anything that was, like, that I can say was wrong. They were simply riding the jeep all night, all through the night. Right? It was long night, so I kept seeing them moving back and forth in the suburbs of Ramallah with kind of very strong flashlight and inspecting, like having this flashlight on all the time, watching the terraces and the orange groves and the olives groves and the houses, and sometimes stopping. The soldiers are being bored, so they stop the beam on some house, maybe they see something inside. And it simply gave such a frightening feeling that you're being inspected the whole time, all the night, every night. It wasn't that something extraordinary happened there, but that's life under occupation. If you leave your house in the night, you will be questioned. I didn't see anybody that did anything that I can say was wrong. But I wouldn't like to be in that position. Other routines of the occupation that are kept being brought is the roadblocks. That actually, this is something that came to life only after Oslo agreements, only after the peace came, which is kind of measure that there is a hot debate whether it enhances the security or only a kind of way that Israel punish the Palestinians, but only within the occupied, the West Bank, there are tens and maybe hundreds of roadblocks with people, soldiers in there. Some do their work more faithfully, some do their work less faithfully. But the end result is that it's almost impossible for Palestinians to move from village to village. And when it's possible, it's in a price of, like, rides that should take 15 minutes can take 6 and 8 hours, if they are accomplished at all. Sometimes it becomes dangerous. The curfew that, in fact, in the last months, last almost 2 months since the second operation of taking hold of the Palestinian cities began, over 1 million Palestinians can leave their house only in a very narrowly designated hours that the army allows them to buy food supply and to go back to their houses.
The flyers for this event have been posted beyond the confines of the American Jewish community. What are you, I think that means Courage to Refuse, doing to reach the American Jewish community while at the same time trying to avoid the strong anti-Zionist voice in America, who see the world in black and white and thrive on finding Jews who say that Israel is wrong.